Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 303, I chat with Larry Pace, president of Darby Vision, about his company's video processing. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 29th, 2016. Episode 303, Darby's Vision. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Optical Cables by Corning. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. And by CuriosityStream, a subscription streaming service that offers over 1,400 documentaries and nonfiction series from the world's best filmmakers. Get unlimited access starting at just $2.99 a month. And for our audience, the first 2 months are completely free if you sign up at curiositystream.com/TWiT and use the offer code TWiT. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Larry Pace, president of Darby Vision, makers of one of the most well-respected video enhancement processors on the market. Hey, Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here today.
It's great to have you here. Before we get started, I want to make sure everybody knows that those who are watching live at live.twit.tv and logged into the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Larry, I thought we would start with a little brief history of the company, Darby Vision, which was founded by Paul Darby. And I have to say I'm very happy to have had him as a guest on my podcast a few years ago now. And I'm very sorry to say that he has passed away. But his legacy lives on, and quite a legacy it is, too. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how the company got started? What was his inspiration, and how did you get involved?
Sure, happy to. You know, Paul's been around for a while in his efforts to do creative things. He was a serial entrepreneur, and it is a fact that it was about 4 decades ago that he stumbled upon this discovery that you can embed disparity depth information into 2D images to get a gratifying result. And the quick romp through the through that history is that at the time he was experimenting with stereo cameras for machine vision application, and he stumbled onto the fact that if you defocus one of the cameras and subtract that image from the other, what you're essentially doing is smuggling in the disparity depth cues, and the resulting image is very gratifying and has properties of dimensionality that are not possible with the conventional fidelity factors. So, despite
before you go on, let's make sure we all understand the word disparity as you're using it.
Yeah, I'd like to. That's a good idea because this is really the whole crux of the matter, and it is that when you see the world through two eyes. It's unlike what you're doing when you're capturing an image with a monoscopic camera. You're seeing the world through two views, and so you can, you know, replicate this with two camera views. But if you capture a scene with two views, what you're able to do, like you're able to do in your visual system, is you're able to do computation on those two images. And one of the things you can do is to calculate the difference or the disparity between those two images. Now, it's well known in vision science that our brains and our visual systems do this to help us interpret the environment. But I say it's the crux of the matter because a monoscopic camera immediately throws away the ability to have the disparity information because you only start with one view. Mm. So this is how we stumbled onto the fact that you can leverage that difference information and leverage it. I mean, you can take that difference information, help you to modulate a single 2D image in ways that are certainly unconventional. Our approach is regarded as coming from left field, but the result is absolutely apparent. It's a stunning result. The amount of depth, clarity, realism, and dimensionality that you get in the resulting image is sometimes profound.
Well, we're gonna get more deeply into that for sure. But what I want to make sure everybody understands is that we're not talking about 3D imagery here. You know, everyone, most home theater geeks know about 3D, stereoscopic, right? You go to the movies, you get a pair of these glasses, and people are kind of bummed about having to wear glasses. And 3D, per se, in the home, came and sort of went. It's still there, but it's not nearly as prevalent as it used to be. Some manufacturers are taking it out of their TVs, as a matter of fact. But that's not what we're talking about here. You're still seeing a two-dimensional image that has been processed with Paul's technology, right?
Yeah, it's processed with technology, and the way Paul would put it, which is pretty fascinating if you think about it, by embedding that additional information into a picture, you're turning the picture into a technology that helps you to see the picture better. And that's what really caught my attention back when I first got involved. I seem to understand it kind of intuitively, and it's unique, and because of its uniqueness and the fact that, as you say, you don't need a special display technology, you don't need to capture with a special set of camera systems, I just felt that this just had the full potential to be ubiquitous and part of the digital imaging space.
So you said Paul was working on this starting 40 years ago. He came to an idea that you could embed this disparity information, the information that would normally come from two eyes seeing the world in stereo, into a 2D image. And he, I guess, decided that could be made into a processor and sold as a product.
Yeah, quickly running forward, he obviously realized that there wasn't much commercial potential for it back then. There just wasn't a lot of stereo capture being done. There wasn't a lot of availability of stereo image sets. And so, and it was also in the analog world that he was working. And so he put it aside and did other things like invented the universal remote control and founded Universal Electronics.
You know, oh, that's right. I remember. You're right. That I hadn't forgotten that. But yeah, you're right that he was involved in that whole thing too, which has become a huge business.
Yeah, you would say, you know, he struck gold once and he was hoping that Darby Vision would be his second great thing that he brought to the world. But, we're going to make sure that happens. Unfortunately, as you said, he passed away a couple of years ago. But the technology legacy that is left with visual presence is just really, really exciting. We had to solve, you know, many problems coming forward. One of them, as he brought this technology into the digital world through a software program back in the early 2000s, was that even in the early 2000s, there wasn't a lot of stereo imagery to have available. So the first obstacle to overcome was, how could you do this with a monoscopic single image? You know, the world is filled with 2D images, but we really need to have that alternate viewpoint information in order to get this process to work. And fortunately, he was able to fairly readily overcome that obstacle. And then the remaining obstacles really relate to making it run in real time and making it a practical solution for application to consumer electronics products.
Mm-hmm. Now, you told me when we were talking about doing the show of how you became aware of his work in Hollywood. And it was an interesting story, so I'd like for you to tell it.
Well, actually, the preface to that was I saw two movie posters leaning up against a wall, and I could instantly see that one of them looked different than the other. And some people may not understand that our technology works on any kind of display technology. In other words, it works for printed images as well. The depth
cues. Oh, really?
Are there. And when you look at a printed image, you get the same benefit as you would if you saw it on a reflective or emissive display. So that was my absolute first experience seeing the comparison of an image that had Darby processing and an image that didn't. But
that was on these two movie posters.
Yeah, it was just uncanny because I could see there was a difference, but I really didn't understand why. I just knew one of them looked more dimensional, and so I asked why. And that's really how I got introduced to the team at that time, was through my curiosity of what was going on with these two posters.
Hmm.
About 6 months after that, I found myself at Photochem in Los Angeles, post-production facility there. We had a D5 studio master tape, uncompressed. What had been done with this clip from this movie was it had been decoded to frames, uncompressed, and then processed using Paul's software, and then re-encoded back, uncompressed, to this D5 tape. And they were playing it out of a, $200,000 machine to the studio reference monitor. Now, my purpose there was to bring some potential investors. But really what happened to me was the experience of seeing Darby processing on studio-grade material, which is, you know, much, much higher quality, much better fidelity than even we're able to watch up till now in the home. Mm-hmm. But what happened was I was so amazed by what I saw. You know, it was literally like this draw hanging, to my lap kind of experience, that's really what sold me to get involved with the company long term and do whatever I could to get this technology into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. UJ in the chat room is asking, how is the process not compounded when viewing with two eyes after Darby Vision has been added this disparity data? Now, we're going to be getting more deeply into the technology itself, so that question may very well be answered. But if you have any sort of preliminary comments to talk about that, how do we you're seeing a 2D image with two eyes, and you've got this disparity information in there, which we'll talk about more later. But I guess the question, UJ, correct me if I'm wrong, is how is it that looking at it with one eye, looking at it with the other eye, that are separated by a certain amount, as all eyes are, that you don't sort of get a double effect?
Sure. Well, see, the disparity cues are not in that image originally, because they couldn't have been captured by the camera. And so once they're embedded, they only exist once. So you don't create disparity by looking at something unless that thing is the natural scene and you get the opportunity to see it originally with your two eyes. The flat 2D image is not the natural scene. It's a representation of the scene, but without the disparity cues. And so once we add them once, then you get to appreciate them for the fact that they're there.
Mm. Well, and it does, the effect is quite remarkable, and we're going to show some examples of it. In fact, we're going to dig a little deeper into the technology right now. But first, before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is Optical Cables by Corning. Now, Corning can greatly improve your audio-video workflow with their strong, durable, and far-reaching Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 fiber optic cables. Whether you're into high-end video, photography, audio production, or computing, Optical Cables by Corning will allow you to build a convenient workspace through a superior long-distance connection. Corning's USB 3.0 and Thunderbolt cables are incredibly strong and flexible. They have exceptional cable runs up to 60 meters, or 200 feet, for Thunderbolt, and 50 meters, or 165 feet, for USB 3.0, making it so easy to move noisy, space-consuming devices away from your workspace. You can bend or walk on Corning cables as well. Even if they're tangled, it's no problem. They keep transmitting at top speed. Optical cables by Corning will help you achieve acoustic and electrical isolation so you can enjoy a clutter-free, peaceful working environment. Now, there's one testimonial that I'm very impressed with, and that's from Universal Audio, makers of very high-end audio interfaces, which I covered when I was a journalist in the professional audio area. Universal Audio relies on optical cables by Corning to achieve acoustic isolation in their studio, where they test new equipment, such as their best-selling Thunderbolt audio interfaces. And I can tell you, they really are fantastic. And the fact that they use optical cables by Corning just tells you everything you need to know, really. They're all about quality, and the optical cables by Corning deliver that in spades. Instead of investing on multiple extenders, adapters, and cables, turn to optical cables by Corning to establish the connection you need with one simple long-length cable. Optical cables by Corning are available at all major electronics and professional AV retailers, including Apple stores, Amazon, B&H, and more. Optical cables by Corning are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. And we thank Corning very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. So, Larry, let's talk about the technology itself. I believe you call it visual presence. And I would love to hear what you have to say about it, is specifically, how the heck does it work?
Well, I can certainly do that, and I can do it without giving away our secrets too, Scott.
I'm not asking you to give away trade secrets, no.
We do provide a white paper on our website that will give you a pretty good flavor. It's written very lightly from a marketing standpoint. So if those of you that want to take a deeper dive into the explanation than maybe I'll give right now, you can do so and read the story of the genesis of the technology, because it's actually quite fascinating. But what I usually explain when people ask to understand more about the technology is, I say, let's just say that we can break it down into three parts. And the first part is that obviously we're starting with a single 2D image. There's no stereoscopic pair or multiplet to work with. So what we have to do in order to get this disparity information is we have to mathematically synthesize what would the image look like if we saw it from the right, and what would the image look like if we saw it from the left. And once we have that information, we have the disparity or the difference between the original image and that outlying right and the outlying left image. We actually use a tri-view approach rather than just a simple stereo view approach. Our process, the first piece, is akin to kind of a 2D to 3D transformation. For a while,
possible. A lot of people have done it.
Sure. There are even TVs that came out with 2D to 3D features in them, real-time processing of 2D material to convert it into 3D, and then you could watch with the glasses and have that experience. But what we do is we need that alternate viewpoint information. So in the case of a 2D image, we mathematically synthesize it, obviously very quickly, and then we hand it off to part number two of the technology. And that's the, I mentioned before, defocus and subtract. Now, if you were to, if you were in photography and you heard the term defocus and subtract, you would know that that equates to unsharp mask. And in enhancement, unsharp mask is a filter that brings out high frequency information in the image, making it appear more clear. For our purposes, for the fact that it's essentially an unsharp mask, only quite different, is important. The reason that it's different is because With an unsharpened mask, you're defocusing and subtracting an image from itself. With our process, you're defocusing and subtracting an image from an alternate view of the same scene as the original image.
So in other words, you're taking the synthesized alternate view or disparity information and defocusing and subtracting that.
Right. And so when you use that fact that it's a different image than the source image, it's not the same as an unsharp mask. And what it avails itself of is the ability to use that information to then modulate simply the luminance of each pixel. And that is, all we do is make a pixel one by one, each pixel either brighter or dimmer or do nothing. And that process of pixel by pixel modulating the brightness and the dimness of the pixel, for HD is done at 165 million times per second. But it's governed by the third part of our technology. And I should say this is probably the largest part of our technology is what we call the perceptor. Now, the perceptor is in image science terms called a saliency mask or map. And what that is it's a way of assessing the content of an image and then making decisions based upon the segmentation of the image. So we're scanning the image very, very, very fast and making real-time decisions as to what to do to each pixel based upon what our saliency map tells us is interesting in the picture to pop and what's not interesting in the picture. And therefore, we can, in real time, differentiate where somebody's face is, what the object of interest is, versus something that you wouldn't be paying attention to in the image, like the plain blue sky behind the actor or a flat wall that doesn't need any enhancement. So those are the three parts.
This last part sounds a little bit like artificial intelligence. I mean, how would the processor know what's important to look at and what's not important to look at?
Well, it absolutely is.
Or what the eye would, what the eye be drawn to naturally versus not. I suppose with a sky, you've got a big flat, more or less flat area. And so the processor would probably say, oh, that's probably not that important.
Well, it is artificial intelligence because back in the days that it was a piece of software, we could steer that with knobs and dials and sliders and little controls because we were doing the process grossly out of real time, you know, something like an HD frame every 2 seconds. But in today's modern video days, we need to be able to operate independent of human interaction, and the AI that's built into our perceptor is very, very important to the extent that we actually couldn't produce a commercially viable image with the entire process if we didn't have the perceptor. It's probably 80 to 90% of what makes our solution successful.
Because I was going to ask, when you were talking about defocus and subtract or unsharp mask, sharpening things, of course, the immediate thing that comes to my mind is, well, what about if you artificially sharpen an image, you very often get things like ringing and additional noise and all kinds of problems. So I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that what this perceptor then does is to apply the processing more to things that are important, quote unquote, and less to things that aren't important, which would help alleviate the problem of over-sharpening, edge enhancement, ringing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Scott. And that's one of the reasons that we've gotten the accolades that we have. You know, you have things like sharpening and color boosting in your TV, and you can turn those knobs up and down and do those enhancements already.
And just FYI, I normally recommend for people who buy a new TV, and the five basic parameters, the controls that people can control are brightness, contrast, color, tint, and sharpness. And normally I say you want to turn sharpness basically all the way down, possibly to one or two clicks above zero, because in some cases turning it all the way down will really soften the image. But you really don't want that sharpness control up very high at all because of these problems that can occur.
That's true. And it's amazing how, as you say, on a TV, you can try that experiment. You know, can you turn up the sharpness and get to the point where you see some edge ringing, turn it down slightly so there isn't any. In general, that's going to be a fairly low setting. Now, mm-hmm. the calibrators who, you know, really challenged us in the beginning when we brought our product and technology to market, because they thought that, okay, if you add processing, Darby processing is just going to create artifacts. But lo and behold, because of the internal workings of our image processing pipeline, because of our perceptor, they discovered that you can get that calibrated image, you can set that up as tuned as you want to, and then add our processing to the video chain, and lo and behold, you don't produce artifacts like edge ringing and halos and enhance the noise, which would be so common if we were doing some naive additional filtering.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the remarkable thing about the Darby processor, of which there are a couple, and we'll talk about those in a bit, that normally video files, which is my audience, right, home theater geeks, right, we're interested in the most high-fidelity image with the minimum amount of artifacts. And it's true of audio files as well, that for the most part, you know, enhancement processing is looked upon very poorly. But not so with the Darby Vision visual presence processors. You know, I find them in home theaters of AVS forum members all over the place. It's very highly regarded. And that, to me, is a real testament to Paul's work and your work subsequently, that it really is accepted by the golden eyes. And I suppose not only consumers, but professionals as well, huh?
Yes, that's true. And, you know, we put our product out to introduce the technology really to the home theater market and beyond. And we were hoping to get the accolades from them, the great reviews, the compliments that allow us to, you know, really have the validation. And that happened. And as you say, it was all of this good, positive feedback and our products that did that really allowed us to take the next step, and that is to get built into other people's products. You know, it started in home theater with the Lumigen brand. Now we're in multiple Radiance processors. Then it went to the Oppo Blu-ray player. We're in two of their reference Blu-ray players. We picked up a graphics card for PC gaming. Now we're in the Optima DLP projector, and there are many more coming up that we're going to be excited to announce this year and next year. So it all started with getting our product out there so that we could get the accolades, and we're happy to have satisfied everybody.
In fact, UJ in the chat room is asking, does Darby Vision have any plans to license to display manufacturers? And you've already done it with the Optima. It's the HD28 DSE. That's the particular model that this technology is in now. What about TV? I mean, you probably can't talk about pending agreements with other manufacturers, but do you have television manufacturers lined up to implement this?
Well, what I can say is that it's always been our goal to be ubiquitous. You know, the installed
that's
base.
That's everybody's goal.
Yeah. Obviously, the installed base is huge, so having standalone products makes sense for the near and midterm. Obviously, we're working on getting integrated into as many display and media playing devices as possible, everything from IPTV, set-top boxes, to Blu-ray players, to TVs, projectors, and even mobile computing and smartphone mobile phones.
Well, Dot in the chat room has a very interesting question. Is this technology, could it be used, is it now being used for medical imaging to sharpen up and make more clear images of medical procedures and that sort of thing? Is it FDA approved, or would it need to be?
Well, we've had an amount of interest over the past couple of years to bring it into healthcare for application for X-ray ultrasound. We have a special variant of our IP that's we call Probe. That's especially particularly for medical applications. And currently, we're working on some applications in the dental space as well as for MRIs. So yes, it is being picked up in those arenas, and it works really well for those that want to look at imaging that relates to examining health, and we're happy to be in that space as well.
Yeah, it seems like a natural application, and one I hadn't thought of until Dot brought it up in the chat room. So thanks very much to you, Dot. Well, we're going to see some examples of how this technology works, but before we get to that, I want to thank our second sponsor for this episode, which is CuriosityStream. Now, CuriosityStream is the world's first ad-free nonfiction streaming service founded by John Hendricks, the founder of Discovery Communications. And I have to say, I'm super excited about having these guys as a sponsor for this show. And in fact, it's a service that I use myself. I love the Discovery Channel and the other channels in Discovery Communications. And this is just an extension of that that is really, really good. They've got over 1,400 titles and 600 hours of content. And it's available in 196 countries worldwide. It's available also on many different platforms: web app, Roku, Android, iOS, Chromecast, Amazon Fire, Amazon Kindle, and Apple TV. There's a wide variety of science and technology content, plus nature, history, and many more topics. Even better, there's over 50 hours of 4K content, which they just launched. In fact, it's one of the largest 4K libraries on the internet. In addition to documentaries, they also have interviews and lectures, which is also really cool. Their library includes several really, really interesting shows, such as Stephen Hawking's Universe, a series where Stephen Hawking traces the history of astronomical theories and technology. There's Next World, featuring Michio Kaku, another of my favorite scientists, talking about the future of technology, virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and other big technological questions. The human face of big data is very interesting and currently exclusively on CuriosityStream. The Road to the Singularity, Jason Silva and other experts explore the inevitable arrival of superhuman intelligence in this CuriosityStream original documentary. Monthly and annual plans are available, starting at just $2.99 per month, less than a cup of coffee or the cost of one title on competing on-demand platforms. Check out curiositystream.com/twit and use the promo code TWIT during sign-up to get unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series completely free for the first 60 days. That's two entire months free with one of the largest 4K libraries around. Just go to curiositystream.com/twit and use the offer code TWIT at sign up. And we thank CuriosityStream very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Okay, I'd like to take a look at some examples here of this processing, and this is really, really pretty cool. First of all, I'd like to pull up the photo called Lizard, just to give us an overall view. These are going to be comparisons of processing versus not processing. So if we call up the photo called Lizard, tell us what we're looking at here.
Sure. This is a fairly popular image. You can see our processing is applied to the image on the right, and the image on the left was the original image. And for all of the detail and clarity that becomes apparent on this nice close-up image of this green lizard, you can see its, I don't know if you call them scales, but all of the little detail in its skin and around its eyes. And you can definitely see how the local dynamic range is just much more dramatic and more lifelike in the image on the right with our processing.
You know, it's very interesting. I have this processor myself in my home theater, and you know, before you apply it, you look at the image on your TV and you go, that looks great, or your projector or whatever. And then you apply this and you go, wow, it's better. How could it be better? But it is. And you can see it here. If you only saw the image on the left, you would say, oh, that looks fine. But in this comparison, you can see how much improvement there is. And I it's astonishing to me how that works. And in fact, we can look at some more close-up images. You know, a lot of AVS members and videophiles and home theater geeks like me like to do what's called pixel peeping, right? We like to zoom in and see what's going on at the pixel by pixel level. And we've got an interesting set of slides here to show for that. We're going to start with comparison wide, which is a sort of a longer shot, a picture of a castle. Tell us what we're looking at here.
Sure. I want to say that the source image is a 4K image. And what we've done is we've set up in a image viewer and then just captured the screen is a side-by-side-by-side comparison of the source image on the left, an image that has been naively sharpened in the middle, and then
Talking about before.
Right.
Just with the sharpness control or something like that.
Correct. And then the Darby processing for the image on the right. And just in this kind of, you know, a little further back view of this castle wall, you can see that both the sharpening and the Darby processing have a property that's different than the original image. But the reason for setting up these comparisons is so that we can start to examine the pros and cons of different processing, and we'll get that in greater detail as we zoom in. Already at this view, if you look at the blue sky, you can see that there's something going on with a coarseness even from this far back. But I think you have a few more shots that we can talk about that allow us to zoom in and pixel peep, as you say.
Yes, exactly. The next one is called Comparison Close. And so here we're zoomed in a little bit more and point out what we should be looking for here.
Sure. So a reminder, the source image is on the left and the Darby is on the far right and the sharpened image is in the middle. And here you can clearly see that there's a coarseness in the sky. And you can start to see that along the vertical edge of the castle, there's a dark line. And as we get closer, we'll take a closer look at that. But already you can start to notice some of what you know, we would call the egregious artifacts that can arise when you do naive processing. And the blue sky is an example of, you know, you don't want to process there because it's an area that if you enhance that, you'll pick up noise. And lo and behold, with naive processing, that's what you get in the central image.
Mm-hmm. So this is where the perceptor comes in, as you were talking about earlier, that that part of the intellectual property says, oh, the sky isn't, we don't need to process that as much. And so it does.
Right. So it's the artificial intelligence that you said. Yeah, mm-hmm. Our software says, don't process that area, focus on these other areas.
And so we're going to go closer in yet to a picture called Comparison Ringing. So we're going to take a particular look at ringing, which is an artificial line or halo around sharp edges. So tell us about what we're seeing here.
Sure. So the image you want to focus on compared to the original is the middle image. And then we'll talk about our image on the right there. But in the middle image, you'll notice that along the vertical edge of the castle wall. Now, we're seeing down at, you know, individual pixels now. I'm sure everybody can see on the screen. And as you know, people at home don't watch TV this way. But you'd be amazed how important this is to the engineers and the people creating consumer electronics products for the quality of their image. You can see along that vertical edge that there is an abnormal amount of darkness in that edge now, and even a band of lightning right next to the dark band of darkness. So you have that issue, which, you know, this is haloing or edge enhancement that is by and large illegal in image processing. You can also see a dramatic pickup of all the coarseness that's created in the blue sky. Now, if you look over on the right on the Darby image, We're not enhancing the edge at all. In fact, if you were to look at this on a pixel scope, you would notice that those edges are virtually identical to the starting source image, and the blue sky is virtually identical to the source blue sky. Not only is this the holy grail of imaging, not doing these bad things, but it's you know really hard to do, and so that's why we're appreciated so much, is we're able to provide, as you might say, you know, all of the good and none of the bad.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but let's take a look at the fourth image called comparison noise. And this is just going to be another example of that sky noise.
Yeah, I set this image, set it up, sent it to you, and focus on the blue sky. You can see in that center image how coarse that blue texture has gotten. I didn't even notice down below that, but if you look at the edge of the castle that's peeking up into that blue sky, you'll notice again that white halo around the edge. Yep. And that's that edge ringing that we were talking about.
Yep, exactly right. And then finally, we have a little video clip that you can tell us about. It's called, what is it called? Cliff Swipe. So let's take a look at that and tell us what we're looking at here.
Sure. You know, we love seeing our process on organic stuff because it just pops so well. But here we have a nice, smooth playing video of the scenery. That vertical black line that you see, you only get if you want to see it. It's a feature in our demo mode, so you can put it on swipe and get this before and after. But what's happening is the processing is being pulled on from the right. And then when it gets to the left, it will reverse and get swiped off to the right. So you can see that there's a tremendous pickup in the local dynamic range. You get a lot more detail, clarity, more apparent depth in the scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, this brings up Drew Nielsen's comment here, which is, isn't any alteration of the original image a bad thing? I thought that the goal was 100% fidelity to the original image, not quote unquote improving it. I'm sure you must get this comment a lot. How do you respond?
Sure. And we spent the first year when we had a product introduced to the market getting kind of beat up from the calibration guys and the purists, if you'll call them that, you know, people that really want to stick to that line of thought. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's been a endeavor of mankind for over 100 years to make images appear more like they do in real life. And so, you know, we don't fault cameras for being monoscopic and unable to capture the disparity depth information. That's just the nature of the technology. But what is real is that we're trying to bring our experience of viewing images to come more closely to what we experience in real life. You know, flat 2D images are actually an invention and something that we've learned all our lives to see as a representation of the world. So being able to put the computed information into the image so that it helps you to see it better, we view as just another natural progression of our desire to get closer and closer to an immersive experience that's more like how we experience the world. We experience the world with dual eye vision, and it comes along with the ability to compute depth cues, and we appreciate them in our natural life. Why not enable pictures to be a technology and express that to us so that we can have a similar experience when we see the pictures?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true that monophonic that too, monoscopic imagery is not what we see in the real world. That is, unless we only have one eye. But for the most part, most of us see stereoscopic. And so, as you say, it's a limitation of the technology that Darby Vision, I think, is trying to address. And I think quite successfully, without having to put on those damn glasses that nobody likes.
Without the glasses. And I will add one more point that, you know, there are other monoscopic cues that do a good job of helping us interpret what's in an image. It's not mm-hmm. just disparity cues, but if you can push monoscopic vision cues gracefully and strong enough, then you can, and particularly the way we do it, then you can get an experience that's beyond fidelity. And there certainly isn't anything inherently wrong with having an experience that feels like more like you're looking out of your head rather than a flat poster.
Mm-hmm. Loquacious in the chat room. It's like when I put on my glasses. Exactly. Me too. Well, we're going to talk next about sort of plans for the future, that sort of thing. But before we do, I have one more sponsor to thank for this episode, and I'm very grateful to Epson. Now, Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an innovative refillable ink tank. It comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages, equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years. Powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, it delivers high-speed, vivid colors and laser-quality black text, plus auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. It's no wonder the ET4550 printer was named a CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Now you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Epson, exceed your vision. So, we're talking about Darby Vision, and I'm talking with Larry Pace, president of the company, and the visual presence processors that have been on the market now for a couple of years. When did your first standalone processor come out?
Well, in 2012, we started early in the year with just a couple hundred units, but, you know, we kept promising to build more units, and they kept selling before we even made them. So that was our first year and our first sign that we had something that was going to work.
Yeah. We have a photo, actually, or a slide called Darby Vision History, and we want to show how things progressed over the years. Started with software, I guess, huh?
Yeah, sure. Great slide because it really shows that we started as a software program that could run a render farm, and that's where it was introduced to Hollywood back in the early 2000s. And Robert Altman, a famous director, actually used it on a couple of his films. We got a really good understanding of what the industry wanted, would tolerate, would not tolerate. In other words, you know, can't mess with colors and things like that.
Man, talk about golden eyes. Those guys are serious golden eyes.
So serious, hard-earned lessons coming out of the experience of having a business model around post-production and running a render farm. But really, it was the precursor to the grand plan, and that was to put the software, port it into a piece of standalone hardware so that it could run modern video in real time. And so, you know, we brought the technology out around the world to all the major labs when we had a hardware kit. We got such great feedback from the early demos at early CEDIA shows in our company history that we decided to go ahead and launch the DVP 5000 product, which, funny enough, it was an engineering prototype that just started to sell so well that we didn't change the design despite, you know, people saying it was kind of too retro looking. We made a little brother for it called the 4000, which was, instead of an HDMI 1.4, was an HDMI 1.3 device. And then we started getting a lot of requests from the custom installer group. You know, these are guys that want to put our product into a rack mount in a closet, and they complained that, you know, they're having to duct tape and Velcro our little product in and around in order to have it there. You know, why can't they have a form factor they can just slot in? And so between that and understanding that they generally want to take HDMI over a long throw, we added Phase HD chipsets there, a little shout out for Phase HD, in order to satisfy their interest in having a good integrity for the HDMI signal over long distances.
And we should say, before we go on, we should say Phase HD, their technology, and I think I've had one of their guys on the show, basically allows for longer HDMI cable runs without degradation. And the problem with HDMI, of course, is that after it gets past a certain length, you start seeing sparkles in the image, and then the image just drops out altogether. So putting Phase HD technology into the custom install version, if you will, I think is a really good idea, because custom installations very often need long HDMI cable runs.
Yeah, they just need that bulletproof performance. And so that fixed the problem. Now, the general consumer doesn't generally have the long throw problem because they're putting the device, you know, right close to the TV and the Blu-ray player. The cable box is all right there. Mm-hmm. So we haven't needed to put it into our consumer products. But what we needed to do over time was to refresh the 5000, and we did that recently with the 5000S. I would say that the S is for sexy because it's much more beautiful.
All right.
And, you know, but we reintroduced the product. We're walking it into consumer and gaming. We're looking forward to, you know, getting a lot more years out of this very simple plug-and-play unit, the DVP-5000S. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, we have, in the meantime, also with the emergence of these incredibly powerful cloud systems, both, well, there's many of them, but we created what we call Darby On Demand because our need for this emerged at the same time the need to show our 4K processing emerged, only we didn't have hardware that we could run it on, and we didn't have a way to let people play with our processing at super resolution or 4K and beyond pixel resolutions. We knew that the way to solve this was to leverage these tremendously powerful cloud platforms, and so we recently just completed the first major pieces of our cloud-based platform. We'll be releasing that for use fairly soon here because it's so robust. We're able to do virtually real-time Darby Visual Presence processing through a web browser, but using a cloud-based system instead of a standalone hardware device.
That's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm talking a little fast here.
No, it's quite all right. Yeah. Quite all right.
And then we have other partnerships that are arising, and one of them that's particularly interesting is in the IPTV OTT set-top box space. And
holy smokes! That's a mouthful.
Yeah, you know, so much video and media is going to be consumed through these little but, you know, amazingly featured devices. These are small little boxes that have Android OS. They, you know, suck Wi-Fi, and they're able to really fairly thoroughly satisfy a lot of the media consumption needs. Some of them even have a built-in removable hard drives for tremendous storage and playing of personal media files. So that's an emerging market that's really exciting that we're going to be putting our technology into, and Genea Tech is our first partner in that part IPTV sector.
Got it. A couple questions from the chat room. UJ is asking, are you going to develop a bioscopic camera, I guess stereoscopic camera, eliminating the need for processing the image after the fact? And that brings up the other question of, if something was captured with two cameras, can your processing take that data and use that as the disparity data and not have to synthesize it?
Yeah, great question, because what it essentially asks is, you know, are we going to go back to our roots? And, you know, our roots, one of our original camera systems is sitting down in the lobby of our office. And I've asked the guys, you know, it's time. The hardware is inexpensive enough that we really got to put together Cam 2, which means that we really need to put together a camera system that does this in real time, and you know, show that around too. It's not a focus for us at this time, but I think it would be extremely interesting for people to be able to see how this and where this originated from. Now, where that evolves to from a business, and you know, evolving it into a business initiative for us, you know, it could go, you know, many directions, but I think.
Sure.
You know, updating our cam to a modern version of it, and showing people then in real time what this looks like with dual view or tri view or multi view live captured video would be very fun to show around.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings up another interesting category that I wanted to talk to you about, which is light field technology. And in fact, next two home theater geeks are going to be talking about this technology. But for now, let's just say that it uses a multi-camera array, which you mentioned there, and captures a scene not in 3D. I mean, it could be 3D if you wanted to make it that way, but it captures a scene from different perspectives, and it captures light rays coming in from a scene, coming in different angles. How have you worked at all with light field technology, and how would that affect what you're doing?
Sure. We, you know, I started looking at that back in the fairly early days of the Stanford Planoptic arrays, that they were developing an array of cameras, and then, you know, they got it smaller and smaller until eventually all of those viewports are on the capture plane of a single chip, thousands of capture viewpoints on a single chip. And so the emergence of light field photography and light field video capture is really exciting for us, because again, it brings us full circle back to the origins of our technology. And you know, mainly what I can say about it is an opportunity for us to have more and more multi-view that we can feed into our processing to create this wonderful embedding depth approach to making images more realistic and more interesting.
Just sounds like a natural to me. Now, Drew Nielsen is asking a question that brings me to my next point. He's asking, will HDR, high dynamic range, make Dolby Vision obsolete or unnecessary when watching HDR content? And this brings up the whole issue of, now we're entering the age of ultra HD, 4K, high dynamic range, wide color gamut, all of these things that we talk about on this show all the time. And so the question really is, how does Dolby Vision fit into that? Up till now, your processor has been working at 1080p, right, in high definition.
Correct.
And you mentioned that the Dolby Online service could, in fact, work with higher resolution images. But what about 4K Ultra HD TVs, high dynamic range imagery, which we're now starting to see come from IPTV and over-the-top type services? How does Dolby Vision fit into that ecosystem?
Sure. You know, Paul, you know, before I started working with him, did some, you know, really, really big pictures. I mean, 20 megapixel image, you know, big, big pictures that, you know, could become billboards or giant art prints. And it is true that the more pixels you add, you still get the same delta of enhancement. It's not about the number of pixels. Our processing is not about the standard dynamic range or the high dynamic range. Adding more stops between the black and the white is mm-hmm. wonderful. Adding more colors to the gamut is wonderful, because really what you're doing with all of those factors is you're giving the ability to express the fidelity to the scene. But if we go back to these disparity difference cues that we were talking about at the beginning, you'll realize that a perfect camera with the perfect amount of high dynamic range, the perfect amount of color capture capability, still does not capture the difference cues that are computed in your head that they don't arise
when you're looking at the real world. Yeah.
Right. So a camera can't capture those things because they're not in the scene. They are computed in your head, and therefore you get to experience them. So even the best dynamic range, even the best amount of colors, bring on 8K, 16K, you know, let's keep increasing the fidelity to the scene. But ultimately, in order to get that extra pop that we provide, you need to compute the disparity and add it, and then you get to really see the scene with the depth cues in the way that our processing allows you to appreciate.
Mm-hmm. So it will be just as applicable to 4K, 8K, whatever resolution you want, as well as high dynamic range and wider color. What you're talking about is something completely separate from all of those things.
Yeah, we call it fidelity independent.
Very good. I like it. Aspire's got a great question here. What, if any, difference do you see when a video has been created with Dolby Vision? By video, I guess you mean content, a movie or a TV show or whatever. Applying it at the content creation end as opposed to applying it at the playback end. Is there any difference?
By and large, no. We say that our processing can be applied at any time in the life of a pixel. And you hand it down the chain, again, no matter what display you technology that you watch it on, you'll get to appreciate it. So, I mean, that's a consumer choice, hopefully, in the future. When I say we want to be ubiquitous, we can be all the way right at the image sensor, out at in a storage device, at distribution head end. We can be in post-production. We can be applied to the media after it's played out, you know, from a Blu-ray player, or we can be in the TV. So we really don't, it doesn't matter when the technology is applied, you'll appreciate it at the display end.
Mm-hmm. Well, this brings up another question that I had, which is, say a piece of content was created and Dolby Vision processing, visual presence processing, was applied at the creation end of things. And then it gets to the consumer, and the consumer has a Dolby Vision processor, either a standalone box or maybe it was incorporated into their TV or some other device, set-top box. What happens when it's double processed? That's normally not a good thing.
Yeah, we call it the double Dolby processing dilemma. And
I like it. That's great.
This obviously came up, you know, years ago. And so we had to, you know, start formulating plans for solutions to it. And yeah, it represents a good situation for our company because it means that, you know, our processing is all over the place. And that's a wonderful position to be in. But
yeah, no
from
kidding.
From an engineering practical standpoint, you know, there's things like metadata, there's image analytics, there's watermarking, and many ways for us to determine whether a source has Dolby processing already applied and at what level, what mode, what level. And then the downstream device can just make a decision, and the consumer decides either to turn off additional processing or add more lightly, or, you know, anything.
And that's another point we should make sure everybody understands, is that the processing can, there are different levels that you can apply. You can, there's a control, basically a knob, that says, I only want to apply a little bit. I want to apply a bunch, or something in between. I've generally found that, a setting around the 50% area, really works best for me.
Yeah, you're right in there with many of the video files in home theater who tend to use it in that range. And then some of us who are a little less of a golden eye and, you know, do a lot of casual watching rather than, you know, have a high-end home theater and want, you know, combination of all the smoking best devices. We're just casually watching, might have a little higher setting. But fortunately, we have three different modes, and you can turn them from 0 to 120 and suit your particular taste.
Mm-hmm. Drew Nielsen, who's been coming up with some great questions today, wouldn't the best solution be to just shoot everything in 3D? Because then you would automatically have this disparity information without having to synthesize it.
Well, you know, that is probably an ultimate goal, to get really good captured and really good processed and really good capture displayed 3D through some system that you attach to yourself and embed in yourself that gives you a very comfortable experience. You can also add our technology to the frames of 3D material and make what you might call a super 3D. But, you know, we're a long way away from making 3D really comfortable, making it comfortable from the standpoint of just what you see being comfortable, as well as having to have goggles or glasses or all that extra stuff. So, you know, getting completely immersed in a 3D experience, virtual reality, augmented type of experience that's truly 3D. It's certainly out there in the future, but I don't think we're anywhere near it right now.
Yeah, plus I think it's kind of ironic. It would be kind of ironic to shoot in 3D in order to create a better 2D image. That's kind of an interesting backwards way to looking at things. Well, listen, we've come to the end of a fascinating hour. I want to thank you so much for being here. What a great technology. I mean, I'm a proponent of it myself, and I know a lot of other people who are. And I wish you all the best success in the future. And when you've got some more things to talk about, I hope you'll come back on the show.
Good. Thank you, Scott. It's always a pleasure being interviewed by you. We've got a lot of great things coming out in 2016. So I'm definitely looking forward to getting you the updates as they emerge over the next couple of months.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So you can find out a lot more about Darby Vision at darbyvision.com. That's D-A-R-B-E-E vision.com. You can find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, as I said, my guest geek is scheduled to be Ryan Dam, a co-founder of Visby, which is a company that is involved with light field technology. This is a very cool technology that I've known about for a number of years, and heard quite a bit more about at NAB this year. So I asked Ryan to come on and explain it to us, and he agreed to do it. So I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.